existent. Winners often seem to have a sixth sense that helps them successfully navigate turbulent political waters. Upon entering a room of complete strangers, they can quickly determine who actually has power and who is just faking it. They get along with even the most prickly people and can bring up controversial issues without provoking or offending anyone. When others play destructive political games, they are able to respond with subtle countermoves. And if they set their sights on a goal, they almost always get what they're after. In short, winners are blessed with political intelligence. The need for political intelligence is universal. Anyone, in any job, can use these skills to make work more productive and pleasant. After years of talking with clients from all walks of life, I have concluded that people from the production line to the executive suite are troubled by similar issues and need similar political abilities. Developing a high political IQ can help you do many things. Clearly define the steps that will lead to your goals. Recognize the power relationships in any group. Capitalize on opportunities to increase your personal power and influence. Identify the true motives and hidden agendas of others. Remain focused on important objectives and ignore distractions. Build positive relationships, even with unpleasant people. Respond appropriately to both devious and direct attacks. Turn conflicts and arguments into productive discussions. Avoid wasting energy on irrelevant issues and unattainable goals. Politically intelligent people also know when they should leave a toxic environment and find a healthier place to work. Although political intelligence may be an innate talent for some, most of us sharpen our political acumen through ongoing process of trial and error. Unfortunately, this learning experience is often painful. The privileged few receive guidance from a wise mentor or trusted advisor, but most people are not so lucky. Fortunately, however, these skills can be taught to anyone willing to examine and change their own attitudes and behaviors. The greatest barrier to becoming a winner is the inability to see yourself clearly, because self-knowledge allows you to make wise choices about your behavior and avoid political pitfalls. Democratic values versus organizational facts of life. The beginning of political intelligence is the acceptance of certain realities that we will call organizational facts of life, OFOL. Unfortunately, many bright and talented people like Alan fail to comprehend that our deeply held democratic values just do not apply at work. Freedom of speech, liberty and justice for all, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. These are not principles that operate on the job. Clinging to the belief that the workplace should function democratically will only doom you to frustration and disappointment. To excel at office politics, you must understand and accept some fundamental facts. The organizational facts of life. OFOL number one. Organizations are not democracies. OFOL number two. Some people have more power than others. OFOL number three. Virtually all decisions are subjective. OFOL number four. Your boss has control over much of your life. OFOL number five. Fairness is an impossible goal. Organizations are power hierarchies, and they are power hierarchies for a reason. If we had to wait for everyone, or even a majority, to agree on a course of action, very little would get done. Some people are therefore given the power to make decisions that others must carry out. Alan got into trouble by failing to accept his place in the power hierarchy and trying to exercise more authority than he actually possessed. Because some people have the power to direct the actions of others, we are constantly affected by the decisions of those above us. A frequent lament is that their decisions are too subjective, which is absolutely true. Decisions are inherently subjective because they are made by people, and people base conclusions on their own values, beliefs, goals, and preferences, which may differ from our own. Had you talked with Alan about the conflict over the staff vacancy, he would have told you that Barbara just wasn't being objective about it. If you view the situation objectively, he might say, the correct decision is obvious. My candidate clearly has the better credentials. Barbara's decisions are always so subjective. From her perspective, Barbara would provide a different view. If we hire someone with fundraising experience, then she'll be able to help us raise money to expand our services. And knowing the mayor will give her greater access to people at City Hall. We've already got plenty of people with degrees in counseling, but Alan's so entranced by PhDs that he can't view this objectively. So here we have two people involved in one decision who each think the other is being too subjective. In fact, the only completely objective decisions are those that involve counting, as in, which piece of machinery can produce more grommets per hour, or which plane can hold more passengers. These questions are so easily answered, however, that we don't really think of them as decisions at all. Alan also had difficulty with OFOL number 4. Your boss has control over much of your life. When we go to work, we trade personal control for pay, benefits, interesting activities, a chance to get out of the house, or anything else that motivates us to take a job. At times, we may regret this bargain and attempt to get some of that control back. To maintain the illusion of control, people sometimes do things that can seem rather obtuse to a neutral observer. George, an executive vice president whose company had just hired a new CEO, is a perfect example of this phenomenon. Because George did not like the CEO, he developed the unfortunate habit of complaining loudly about the CEO's management style to anyone who would listen. Upon arriving at work one morning, George's astonished staff found his office completely bare, with no sign that George had ever existed. He had been fired by the CEO and was never heard from again. Why did George choose to engage in such obviously self-destructive behavior? Because pointing out the CEO's weaknesses made him feel superior and therefore more in control, even though it actually had the opposite result. Another example, more sad than stupid, is a secretary named Patsy. One afternoon, Patsy was told that her job had been eliminated and that she could come back the next day to pack up her belongings. The following morning, Patsy's boss found her seated at her desk working away. In a panic, he went looking for the human resources manager. "I don't know what to do," he said. "She's acting as though nothing has changed." When the HR manager spoke with her, Patsy said, "I can't stop now. There are just so many things that I have to finish." In fact, this extreme denial was just helping her maintain psychological control. The reality of losing her job was so frightening that she was clinging to the illusion of being needed. In Alan's case, the root cause of his downfall was the failure to accept that Barbara was indeed his boss. From the beginning, he resented the fact that she was from a wealthy family, a feeling that probably stemmed from his childhood envy of people with money. He felt superior to her because of his greater management experience and because he viewed his visionary style as more advanced than her concern with policies and procedures. Having to report to her was therefore a blow to his self-image. To feel more in control, he chose to point out her deficiencies and to explain how she needed to change. Strategies that would not warm the hearts of many bosses. Barbara quickly got the not-so-subtle message that Alan didn't feel she was qualified to manage him. Unfortunately, Alan completely overlooked the fact that she had more power than he did, both officially as the board chair and unofficially because of her long-standing connections with other board members and her relationship with the mayor. The ultimate organizational fact of life is this: the person with the most power wins. Most of the time, the person directly above you in the hierarchy has more power than you do. Your boss can affect your pay, your reputation, your assignments, your advancement, and the general quality of your life. Once you accept this fact, what naturally follows is the need to effectively manage your boss. We usually think of this the other way around. Your boss is responsible for managing you, and should therefore treat you with respect, courtesy, and, I'll say more about this one in a minute, fairness. But for political success, you need to stop worrying about how your boss treats you and start figuring out how to relate to your boss. The ability to manage upward is an absolutely essential component of political intelligence. One of my personal lessons in boss management came early in my career when I was hired to work as a management development specialist in a large corporation. At this point, I had several years' experience in both management and management training, but in government, not business. Since my new boss was a novice in this field, I looked for any opportunity to demonstrate my superior knowledge. The danger of this approach became apparent when he scheduled a meeting about the new management training program on a day that I had to be out of the office. I was obviously being shut out of this project. From that moment on, I changed my approach and began to communicate with my boss more intelligently, and as a result, was able to learn a great deal from him. In my initial arrogance, I overlooked the fact that he had been with the company for 15 years and knew much more about the business world than I did. Once I stopped being such a show-off, we made a very effective team. Acceptance of the organizational facts of life is an absolute prerequisite for developing political intelligence. Otherwise, you will find yourself constantly agonizing about whether you are being treated fairly, and fretting about fairness is a complete waste of energy. The impossibility of fairness. One surefire way to sabotage your career is to become overly concerned with whether everything is fair. At first, I felt it wasn't fair that my boss left me out of the meeting about management development. Alan definitely felt that having to report to Barbara, a person with much less experience and vision, wasn't fair at all. But people with political intelligence recognize that perfect fairness is both impossible and irrelevant. Most Western cultures are obsessed with fairness. In the United States, the court system is clogged with cases brought by people who only wish to be treated fairly. Our language is filled with references to fairness. A fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Turnabout is fair play. He should have a fair chance. She had an unfair advantage. Be sure you play fair. If you've raised a teenager, or if you've been a teenager, you probably already know that all children, upon approaching their teenage years, begin to chant the same mantra, "That's not fair." The universal parental response to this lament is, "Life's not fair." As parents, when we have the power, we know this to be true. However, at work, where someone else has the power, we immediately forget that life's not fair and begin whimpering about how badly we are being treated. When we tell our children that life's not fair, we are acknowledging that fairness is truly an impossible goal. There is no absolute standard of fairness because fairness is based solely on perception. Inevitably, therefore, any large-scale decision will be met with a cry of, "That's not fair," from some constituency. For example, suppose everyone in an organization is granted a 10% pay increase. Will this universal benefit be perceived as fair? Of course not. People who feel they work harder will resent the fact that everyone is getting the same amount. A fair decision would be to either give them more or give those slackers in the next department less, which, of course, would not seem fair from their perspective. The most unfair decisions are those that simultaneously hurt us and benefit someone else. The promotion that goes to the person who always sucks up to the boss, or the key project given to a less technically competent coworker who is better at schmoozing. Their view, of course, might be different. I got that promotion because I put a lot of effort into working well with the boss and delivering the results she expects. Or, that project requires managing relationships with many different departments. Technical competence isn't enough. Getting worked up about fairness is a waste of time and politically stupid. People who are obsessed with fairness tend to whine, and nobody likes a whiner. Instead of focusing on the past and complaining about unfairness, start looking toward the future and taking concrete steps to achieve your goals. As we will discuss in the next chapter, politically intelligent people concern themselves with leverage, not fairness. Leverage is the key to getting what you want. And if you have enough leverage, fairness is no longer an issue. Personal politics. How good is your relationship with your boss? Assessing your situation, rate your relationship with your manager using a 1-5 scale. 1. I absolutely can't stand my boss. 2. I manage to tolerate my boss despite our differences. 3. We're not a perfect match, but my boss is okay. 4. I get along well with my boss most of the time. 5. My boss and I have a terrific relationship. If your rating is a 4 or 5, be happy. If your rating is below a 4, list the problems that you have with your boss. Are these issues interfering with the achievement of your personal or business goals? Now, think beyond your own reactions. Would most of your coworkers list the same problems with your boss? If so, do any of them seem to cope with this difficult person better than you do? But if not, why do you have a harder time with this manager than others do? Have you had difficulty with other bosses in the past? Or do the two of you just have very different work styles? Moving from assessment to action. You probably can't change your boss, so you need to figure out what you can do to manage this relationship more intelligently. 1. List the situations in which you find your manager's behavior to be most frustrating or annoying. 2. For each situation, list the way that you usually react. How might your behavior make the situation worse? How would your boss describe your behavior? 3. Identify a more productive reaction to these situations. If other people have an easier time with your boss, use them as role models. Set goals for changing your behavior with your boss. How high is your political IQ? Assessing your situation. Note any of the statements that follow that might apply to you. The more statements that seem relevant, the more you may need to work on your political intelligence. I am not as effective as I would like to be in influencing others. I frequently find myself in arguments and disagreements with people at work. I feel that I have often been treated unfairly in work situations. There are certain people that I find it impossible to work with. When I am with a new group, I find it hard to tell where the real power lies. I am often uncertain about the true motives of other people. I find that I am easily distracted from important goals by less important tasks. I find it hard to work with people that I don't particularly like. I often feel that I am being taken advantage of at work. If I feel that I am being attacked or undermined by others, I am not sure how to respond. I get easily upset about matters that are trivial or not relevant to my goals. Management doesn't recognize the true value of the work that I do. Certain situations at work may prevent me from accomplishing goals that matter to me. Moving from assessment to action. As you listen to the rest of this book, keep in mind the items that you noted. Each of them will be addressed in the chapters that follow. As you think about these issues, your task will be to identify the attitudes or behaviors that you need to change to improve your situation. Are you too concerned with fairness? Assessing your situation. Divide a sheet of paper down the middle. On one side, list everything about your work situation that you feel is unfair. How many of these items are related to one of the organizational facts of life? Moving from assessment to action. On the other side of the paper, list anything that you personally might do to affect the things that seem unfair to you. If these issues are important enough, then start taking action to change the situation. However, if you can't think of any way to change it, or if it's not worth your time, then forget about it. Let it go. Any time spent focusing on this unfairness is just a waste of energy that could be more productively directed toward achieving your goals. Chapter 3. Forget fairness. Look for leverage. One sunny Saturday morning, Eric sat on the front porch with his wife, Marcia, waiting for the movers to arrive. They were excited and happy, eagerly anticipating the first day in their new home. A few hours later, however, their mood had changed. The movers had shown up an hour late with a truck too small to hold their belongings. To make matters worse, the workers appeared to be completely untrained. After unloading half the furniture at the new house, one of them dropped an antique desk, smashing it to pieces. For Marcia, this was the last straw. She called a manager at the moving company and threatened to withhold part of their fee because of poor service. The manager then radioed the truck, and on his instructions, the movers locked the van, refusing to unload any more furniture until they had a check for the full amount. So, what does this sad little tale have to do with office politics? Nothing, really. But it is one of the clearest examples I've seen of a leverage miscalculation. Had Marcia been thinking straight, and not overcome with anger at the mover's incompetence, she would have realized that she was pulling a power play at the wrong time. If her goal was a reduced bill to compensate for lousy service, she would have been in a much better position to discuss it once all the furniture was off the truck. Political intelligence requires a thorough understanding of the dynamics of leverage, which simply means your ability to get others to do what you want. If this conjures up visions of people jumping to obey at the crack of a whip, you've got the wrong view of leverage. Those who try to control others through abuse of power and authority usually fail in the long run, or someone stabs them in the back at the first opportunity. When you increase your leverage in more appropriate ways, though, you can be a winner in the game of office politics, and in other areas of life as well. Most of our transactions involve leverage in one way or another. Imagine, for example, that you plan to ask your boss for a raise. Are you more likely to get it if you A, have been a loyal employee for 5 years, or B, have another job offer? Clearly, your leverage increases if your services are desired elsewhere. Or suppose you want to get a coworker to help you with a project. Is assistance more likely to be forthcoming if A, you have helped this colleague in the past, B, this colleague is going to need your help in the future, or C, large bonuses will be paid to project participants? The answer is all of that. Option C might be the most effective, but A and B would increase your leverage as well. Leverage also rears its head in personal relationships. Let's say a guy wants to take off for a 2-week hunting trip in Montana with his buddies. Is his wife more likely to agree to this plan if A, they just spent a romantic weekend at the beach together, or B, he's been working 70 hours a week for the past 3 months? Calculating the leverage equation. The ability to assess your leverage relative to others is a fundamental aspect of political intelligence. In one Dilbert cartoon, a colleague who orders Dilbert to help him winds up with a trash can on his head. "This is where we learn," says Dilbert, "that you are my co-worker, not my boss. In other words, you don't have the leverage to tell me what to do." Winners are able to accurately calculate the leverage equation in any given situation. Even if you've never used the term leverage, I'll guarantee that at some level you are aware of the leverage equation that is always hovering in the background. If you receive bad service and ask to speak to the manager, if you tell the traffic cop that you're friends with the police chief, if you copy your uncooperative colleague's boss on an email, you are simply trying to increase your leverage. One of the most politically hazardous mistakes is the leverage miscalculation. Marsh's transaction with the movers provides an excellent example of this blunder. Her power lay in the fact that she hadn't paid them yet. However, since they were still in control of her furniture, the movers had an equal amount of leverage. Marcia was too angry to realize that as soon as the truck was unloaded, the leverage equation would have shifted in her favor. Leverage miscalculations often create unanticipated and usually unpleasant consequences for the lower leverage person. In the following true stories, consider how these poor unfortunates either failed to assess the leverage equation correctly or chose to ignore it. Brian, an engineer in a large technology company, was asked by his manager to provide regular status updates on certain projects. Because Brian didn't like his boss and didn't like doing status updates, he ignored this request. As a result, he was described as uncooperative on his performance review, lowering his rating and reducing his pay increase. Brian saw this as further evidence that his manager was a jerk. When asked why he didn't simply give his boss the information, Brian replied, "I guess I just don't think I should have to do that." As a person with free will, Brian can certainly choose to withhold information if he wants to. But in the real world, if you choose to defy people who have power, you shouldn't be surprised by the predictable results. Lucy, a regional director in a state mental health agency, was responsible for several county mental health centers. Although the center managers reported to her, their funding came largely from their counties, not the state. For that reason, each center was also overseen by a county board of mental health. Glenda, one of the center managers, had been active in county politics for many years, even holding a seat on the county commission. In Lucy's view, Glenda was a loose cannon and something of a management problem, because she routinely made exceptions to policies and failed to follow standard procedures. Every time Lucy brought up one of these issues, Glenda just said, "Well, I'll see what the county board thinks about it." Then Lucy would get a call from the county board chair telling her that Glenda was doing a great job and reminding her that the county provided most of the money for the center. Glenda, of course, continued behaving as she always had. The moral of this story is that being the boss doesn't necessarily mean that you have the most leverage. John, a vice president of human resources, was less than excited about the new company president, but he had developed a friendly relationship with Wanda, the president's executive assistant, who had come to the company with her boss. John often complained to Wanda about the president's lack of industry knowledge and changes he was making within the company. She would listen politely, never expressing agreement or disagreement. When the president fired him, John was stunned. He had stupidly failed to consider that Wanda's loyalty to her boss would cause her to pass along John's critical comments. Loyalty is always part of the leverage equation. Whether or not people repeat your negative remarks usually depends upon where their loyalty lies. Leverage miscalculations are not limited to individual issues. Entire departments or work groups may fail to assess their leverage accurately. When pilots at a major airline received significant wage increases after threatening to strike, flight attendants decided to follow their example. They went on strike and refused to return to work. But instead of getting raises, the flight attendants got pink slips. Lower-paid workers were hired to fill their positions. These unfortunate employees lost their jobs because they failed to realize that flight attendants simply don't have the same leverage as pilots. Why? Because new flight attendants can be hired and trained much more quickly. Senior managers who are accustomed to having a great deal of leverage may be blindsided when circumstances alter the usual leverage equation. In another interesting airline example, executives at a major carrier that was teetering on the brink of bankruptcy decided to award themselves huge bonuses right after asking their unions for large pay concessions. The resulting furor caused the CEO to rescind the bonuses and publicly apologize. But that wasn't enough to appease irate employees, and shortly thereafter, the CEO resigned. This otherwise intelligent man had obviously underestimated or overlooked the leverage of the unions during a financial crisis. Undesirable outcomes created by inaccurate leverage assessments can range from embarrassing blunders to political catastrophes. To help you avoid such problems, the information that follows summarizes some of the factors that can operate to increase or decrease your leverage. Sizing up your leverage. You have more leverage if you have a higher position, have more occupational status, have something the other person needs, are the sole provider of a resource, have influence with people in authority, have abilities that are hard to replace, have other ways to get your needs met, have a good reputation or track record, have less emotional attachment, have a positive relationship with the other person. You have less leverage if you have a lower position, have less occupational status, do not have anything the other person needs, have strong competition, do not know people in authority, have easily replaceable abilities, are dependent on the other person, have a poor reputation or no track record, have a greater emotional attachment, have a poor relationship with the other person. To make a politically intelligent decision in any situation, you must calculate the leverage equation accurately. Overestimating your own leverage to gratify your ego will just set you up for an eventual fall. But if you underestimate your leverage out of modesty or self-doubt, you will miss opportunities to influence others and make progress toward your goals. Leverage is dynamic. To keep up with changing political tides, you must always be on the lookout for leverage shifts. These power fluctuations occur frequently, both at work and in our personal lives. As children grow from toddlers to teenagers to adults, for example, leverage gradually shifts away from the parents toward the child. Controlling parents who fail to recognize this change will have a tough time when their kids grow up. Leverage can also shift in romantic relationships. If one partner begins to lose interest, the other automatically loses leverage. Misguided attempts to regain leverage by clinging and begging will just make the abandoned partner look weak and pathetic, reducing the poor soul's leverage even further. In the workplace, leverage shifts happen whenever there are promotions, demotions, or reorganizations. Getting a new boss can trigger a leverage earthquake and create a great deal of stress. When a new manager comes in from the outside, having no prior history with the group, all bets are off. Everyone starts from zero and must prove themselves all over again. I witnessed one such dramatic shift when a new vice president assumed control of an information systems department. Under the previous VP, the systems director had been the shining star, while the operations director had received a letter of reprimand. But after a few months under the new boss, the operations director was given more responsibility and the systems director was laid off. A complete leverage flip-flop. When someone is promoted from within the group, leverage shifts may be more predictable. People who were regarded as helpful and cooperative colleagues are now likely to become trusted and valued employees, while former rivals and adversaries may find themselves out of the loop. Sometimes, though, even amiable co-workers can have difficulty with this change. Ed and Tamika worked well together as program specialists in a government organization. After Ed was elevated to the director position, however, Tamika became increasingly uncomfortable with their new relationship. She felt Ed treated her differently from the new program specialists he had hired. He often questioned her decisions and seldom implemented any of her suggestions. After concluding that their previous work history had actually reduced her leverage, Tamika chose to leave for a position with another agency. Because dramatic leverage shifts can occur unexpectedly, political winners follow this principle. Never intentionally offend anyone at work. This does not mean that you have to suck up to everyone, stifle your opinions, or become the little merry sunshine of your office. But you should learn to work with people that you don't particularly like and handle conflicts in a constructive adult manner. Back in my corporate days, I had a boss who should have learned this lesson. Jonathan, the vice president of my department, was constantly at odds with Sam, one of the division general managers. He played power games with Sam, refusing to share information or involve him in decisions. Imagine Jonathan's surprise when Sam was made president of the company, thereby becoming his boss. Leverage shifts can occur for a host of reasons. Changing market conditions, increased competition, new laws or regulations, or the election of a different political party. Winners stay alert for impending changes, allowing them to anticipate shifts and react appropriately, But short-sighted people who either fail to recognize a leverage shift or stick with outdated approaches may eventually find themselves in political Siberia. Leverage versus fairness. When considering some of the examples, you may have found yourself thinking, but that just doesn't seem fair. And I can assure you that the people involved would agree wholeheartedly. But so what? Fairness seldom determines what happens to you at work. Leverage usually does. Low-leverage people spend a lot of time thinking, talking, or complaining about unfair treatment, unfair policies, or unfair management. When I was a human resources director for a large corporation, Alvin was one of the boomerang people, my term for those chronically unhappy employees who predictably came back with new problems on a regular basis. Every couple of months, Alvin would storm into my office complaining about his boss, his co-workers, his work assignments, company policies, company benefits, or some other issue. Compared to his unfortunate colleagues and managers, I was lucky. They had to deal with this litany of grievances on a daily basis. One of Alvin's complaints was that although he did good work, he never got promoted. The sad truth was that he actually was a bright, creative person whose work was indeed quite acceptable. But his constant complaining about fairness issues made people try to avoid him. When no one wants to work with you, your opportunities for advancement are definitely limited. High-leverage people don't obsess about fairness. Instead, they remain focused on actions that will move them toward their goals. Vivian, an accounting manager, showed how high-leverage people respond to difficult situations. During her first 2 years on the job, Vivian received frequent recognition for her efforts to turn around a failing department and modernize corporate accounting practices. Then she got a double dose of bad news. First, the manager, who had been her mentor, left the company, and Vivian began reporting to a new boss whose last-minute changes drove her crazy. Next, the HR manager informed her that her own leadership style had generated a number of complaints from the accounting staff. Because Vivian was a fast-track achiever who had never known anything but success, this was a real blow. She spent one long, depressed weekend lying around the house, obsessively going over the things her staff had said, and wondering if she should just look for another job. But by Monday morning, she had made up her mind to take charge and correct the situation. She met with the staff to discuss their concerns, formulated a strategy to address the issues, and discussed her plan with the HR manager. She also took the initiative to sit down with her new boss and clarify the way that they communicated about changes. As the situation improved over the next few months, Vivian's credibility as a manager actually increased, because she had proven that she could handle a difficult situation in a positive manner. Using your energy wisely. Every morning, you start the day with a fresh supply of energy. By the end of the day, you will have spent that energy allowance on something. You can choose to focus your energy in ways that will increase your leverage and help you reach your goals, or not. Kim Sue was a talented information technology specialist who liked tackling new challenges. When people from various parts of the company asked for help with computer problems, she always responded eagerly. Unfortunately, serving other departments was not actually part of her job, so these outside requests often kept Kim Sue from meeting deadlines on her own projects. Even though this problem was repeatedly pointed out by her supervisor, Kim Sue continued to do the outside work that she enjoyed. When one of her colleagues was promoted to senior IT specialist, Kim Sue was upset and complained that she should have been promoted as well. If promotion was her goal, however, she needed to make wiser decisions about where she focused her energy. Low-leverage people tend to waste a lot of energy on complaining, worrying, blaming, gossiping, scheming, and whining. High-leverage people focus their energy on producing results and building relationships. They concentrate on positive goals and things they can control. After learning about her staff problems, Vivian, the accounting manager, took the high-leverage approach of exploring the issues and identifying changes she could make. Another manager, Chuck, demonstrated a low-leverage response to a similar situation. When an employee survey revealed that his staff had a poor opinion of his leadership skills, Chuck called the employees together, berated them for disloyalty, and told them that he'd be watching them carefully in the future. Word of this tongue-lashing spread quickly through the organization, eventually reaching the president, who was not at all pleased. By allowing anger to drive his response, Chuck succeeded in simultaneously reducing his leverage with both upper management and his employees, demonstrating a remarkable degree of political stupidity. Sometimes you can turn a negative situation to positive advantage by consciously deciding to redirect your energy and refocus your attitude. Mario was one of several customer service technicians who handled phone calls from customers having technical problems. Historically, calls from particularly angry or upset customers had always been transferred to the supervisor of the department. When the supervisor decided to delegate this responsibility to the technicians, they reacted angrily, complaining behind his back that their boss was just trying to escape work he didn't like. I'm sure that the phrase, "it's not fair," was uttered at some point in this discussion. Mario joined in the griping at first, but after a few days he decided to view the change not as a burden, but as an opportunity. Because he wanted to eventually become a supervisor himself, this new responsibility looked like a chance to demonstrate his ability to handle difficult customer situations. Mario assumed a leadership role by convincing the other technicians that their wisest course would be to stop fighting the change, draft some guidelines for handling these challenging calls, and present them to the supervisor. This cooperative attitude definitely increased Mario's leverage with management and made the job change easier for his co-workers as well. Different political types focus their energy in different ways. Sociopaths devote their efforts exclusively to fulfilling selfish desires, while martyrs exhaust themselves by endlessly striving to meet the needs of others or vigorously championing a cause in the face of constant opposition. Dimwits, who tend to be controlled by their emotions, burn up a great deal of energy satisfying unconscious psychological drives. Chuck probably would fall into this category. Winners like Vivian and Mario demonstrate political intelligence by refusing to be held hostage by their feelings. Instead, they concentrate on their goals and take actions that will advance both personal and organizational interests. Leverage boosters. If leverage is the political wonder drug, you're probably wondering how you can get more of it. Unfortunately, you can't promote yourself to a position of absolute authority, so you'll be glad to hear that politically intelligent people have many options for increasing their leverage. Certain behaviors and characteristics are universal power boosters. The power of results. Delivering results that make your organization more competitive, effective, or efficient is guaranteed to increase leverage, particularly if you manage to amaze or delight key decision makers in the process. Should you happen to have a job that allows you to close the deal of the decade, or design a brilliant new generation of products, then you are one giant step ahead in the leverage game. But the power of results is not limited to people in glamour positions. You simply have to figure out how your particular job affects your organization's success. Then look for creative contributions. A retail clerk, for example, created a new way to display merchandise that increased sales of certain products by 200%. The more dramatic the results you produce, the more leverage you will acquire. The power of knowledge. Developing impressive expertise in your work, no matter what job you hold, will cause people to view you as a source of information and a valuable resource. Expertise is especially critical in specialist positions, jobs that exist primarily to provide in-depth knowledge of a certain field, such as law, compensation, information systems, and so on. But the power of knowledge is not the exclusive property of specialists. Customer service reps, for example, acquire a great deal of data about customer problems and preferences. Administrative assistants are often invaluable sources of information about practical shortcuts for getting things done. Receptionists who chat with customers and vendors often pick up interesting facts. Anyone in any job can acquire useful knowledge to share with others. The power of attitude. But, you say, I'm just a cog in the corporate machine. I really don't see how I can acquire influence through results or knowledge. Don't despair. You can boost your leverage simply by being the type of person with whom other people like to work. Consistently friendly, helpful, and cooperative. The power of attitude is particularly evident in the way people react to adversity. So, even if you feel cheated, overlooked, or unappreciated, try to keep your negative emotional reactions to yourself. When you have concerns, strive to address them in a calm and professional manner. Dumping all your true feelings on people is a guaranteed leverage killer. Anyone who believes that complete emotional honesty is a virtue definitely lacks political intelligence. The power of empathy. Most people appreciate a sympathetic ear. As an organizational psychologist, I often find that clients benefit from simply being able to talk about work issues with someone who feels safe. Not that you should strive to become the Dear Abby of your department. That would be counterproductive. But genuinely trying to understand and appreciate others' problems shows that you are not solely concerned with yourself. Beverly, a human resources specialist, was widely known as the person to see if you were having issues with your manager, or as a manager, if you had issues with employees. She was always willing to listen and help people figure out what to do. As a fringe benefit, Beverly gained a great deal of information about what was going on in the company, and that, too, can increase leverage. Of course, you do have to keep any confidences to yourself. Sharing secrets is one way to ensure that eventually no one will trust you. The power of networks. Political intelligence involves building positive relationships. So it logically follows that winners increase their leverage by maintaining helpful connections with as many people as possible. Your network is simply the sum total of all the people you can call on for information, assistance, or advice. And this relationship power is available to everyone in unlimited supply. The more connections you have, both inside and outside your organization, the greater your ability to get things done, and therefore the higher your leverage. As an added bonus, if you ever decide that your best political strategy is to exit for a better situation, your external network will improve the odds of your finding a desirable job elsewhere. The power of inclusion. Involving others in your decisions, activities, and projects can increase support and produce better outcomes. If you happen to have a somewhat solitary nature, becoming more inclusive is definitely a strategy that you should consider. Winners not only take steps to enhance teamwork in their own area, but also try to build bridges to those in other functions. Unfortunately, people seem to have a natural tendency to gravitate toward those similar to themselves, often creating functional or departmental silos. By helping to break down barriers, you will not only increase your leverage, but will also make the business more successful. The power of detachment. Although feeling passionate about your job is a plus, too much passion can be dysfunctional. Dedication to your work may make you credible and persuasive, but those who are too emotionally invested in their jobs can become defensive and inflexible. People who overreact to critiques or constructive suggestions tend to be difficult to work with. So the ability to disengage emotions and view issues objectively can increase your influence. When you develop a reputation as an unbiased and thoughtful observer, others are more likely to seek you out for consultation. As more people consult you, your leverage will increase. Personal politics. How much leverage do you possess? Assessing your situation. Using this ranking system, grab a pen and rate yourself on the leverage boosters discussed in this chapter. Each leverage booster can be rated a score of 3 for definitely, a 2 for somewhat, or a 1 for not really. Results. I produce results that provide a clear benefit to my organization. Knowledge. I possess information that is quite useful to my organization. Attitude. I am viewed by almost everyone as helpful and cooperative. Empathy. People often come to me for help with their problems or concerns. Networks. I know many people throughout my organization. Inclusion. I typically try to include other people in my decisions or projects. Detachment. I am known as someone who can view situations objectively. Count up your points. A score of 18 to 21 indicates that you possess a great deal of leverage. Good for you. You should be able to get a lot accomplished. A score of 11 to 17 shows that you clearly have opportunities to increase your leverage if you choose. If your score is 10 or below, you definitely have some work to do. Moving from assessment to action. If your score is lower than you would like, identify the categories in which you could improve. What are the specific steps you could take to increase your leverage in those areas? What could you do differently in terms of your actions at work or your interactions with people? How are you using your energy at work? Are you concentrating on activities that will help you achieve your goals or wasting energy on low-leverage behaviors? How might you need to refocus? What leverage problems do you have? Assessing the situation. Can you think of a situation in which you miscalculated your leverage? That is, you either underestimated or overestimated the amount of leverage you had? What was the outcome? Does this often happen to you? Think about the last time a management change or reorganization created a leverage shift at your workplace. How did it affect you? Do you find that leverage shifts often create problems for you? Moving from assessment to action. If you have identified previous problems with leverage shifts or miscalculations, revisit those situations. How would you handle them differently if you could do it over again? What advice would you give yourself for handling such situations in the future? Chapter 4. Political Psych 101. Allies and Adversaries. What you do doesn't matter around here. It's all about who you know. That pearl of wisdom usually pops out whenever someone feels they have been unfairly denied some desirable benefit, a promotion, a raise, a choice assignment, or whatever. And in fact,